people here are burning with ambition, right? But they're for the right reason, for the patient, for the program, for neurosurgery, to leave neurosurgery better than they found it.
Today, we'd like to welcome everybody to the AANS CNS section on pediatric neurosurgery podcast series. Today, we are thrilled to have on Dr. Howard Weiner, who is the chief of neurosurgery at Texas Children's Hospital. He's also a professor of neurosurgery and vice chair of neurosurgery at the Baylor College of Medicine. And we're really thrilled to talk to you today, Dr. Weiner. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. It's a huge honor and privilege to be with you today. And hopefully, it will be interesting for folks. So it's a completely non-surgical topic, but I think for me, it's something that it's a very personal meaning. Like the reason I'm interested in this is just says a lot about me. And I mean, I can talk about that if you want to get me on your couch, but I think it definitely has hit a nerve with people in the sense that, you know, we're so focused on the technical part of our job as we should be. But there's very little, there's discussions about wellness, if you will, and what that means. But that's also kind of technical, the way it's discussed. And for me, like, I came here to Houston 8 years ago. And when I was leaving New York, I mean, the thing that really hit me was that, you know, a lot of the notes that I got and the emails and the calls from the patients all had the same structure. They were like, thank you for doing this specific thing for my child, like taking out this tumor, stopping the epilepsy, fixing their shunt, whatever. But thank you even more for being a mensch, for like being kind, warm, down to earth, calling me on the weekend on your own time, you know, not talking down to me. And I think it's really true. Like, even though we're neurosurgeons, we happen to be in the pediatric realm, but what people remember is that is the human side of what we do, the human touch, and also how we make them feel, you know. And then I read that book, you know, and not to get into that so quickly, but just I read the book probably when I moved here. I don't know, somebody heard me talking about this and, you know, at the bedside and said, oh, you have to read this book by this guy, Danny Meyer. And I'm like, of course I know Danny Meyer. I met him in New York. I met him at the NYU FACES Epilepsy Gala, which Oren Davinsky has every year. And Danny's a big supporter of the NYU Epilepsy Center. He's friends with Oren Davinsky. And I met him. I actually asked him if he's going to open a kosher restaurant in New York, and he said no. a big no. So most of the stuff that he has, I can't eat. But I read the book and I'm like, oh my God, this guy, this is exactly how I feel about life. Like, you know, I told you the quote that I started my talk with was, you know, business like life is all about how you make somebody feel. It's that simple and it's that hard. And it's so true. And he's built, you know, this gazillion dollar business on this philosophy. But for me, it's been like, you know, the key thing for me of why patients still are in touch with me. You know, every week I get emails and notes from my patients, and it's always about the human side. It's never really about the technical side. And I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, the technical side is critical, but that's the point. The point is that that's a given. Like, we know what we have to do there, and it's got to be perfect every day. But this other stuff, you know, it sort of moves me. And, you know, I remember, you know, the things that have impacted me in my career are sort of the things that I remember. And it's really how people have made me felt, the good and the bad. Anyway,
why do you think, you know, I know you give this book to all your fellow candidates that come through, and just so we can get it on the recording, so people know, the book that we're referencing is this book, Setting the Table by Danny Meyer. And Danny Meyer is this restaurateur in New York City. And some of his more famous exploits include, you know, Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, and of course, Shake Shack, which is just a huge, huge global, you know, giant in terms of food delivery and customer service and things like that. So why do you think it's so important for the fellows to hear this message? What's your point in that?
So, you know, one of the reasons I came to Houston, I never had aspirations to be like a chief or a leader or something. You know, I'm sort of in the trenches doing my thing, a very simple neurosurgeon. And, you know, I stayed in the same place where I trained. I didn't have any fancy recruitment package or, you know, fancy OR. I joke that Howard Reno, when he came from Cornell, he had like, you know, reps running around the room with all these biplane angiography and, you know, big TV screens and fancy equipment. And they would set up my shunts on Friday night, like in the closet, like, I need my micro set. They're like, you don't have a micro set, Dr. Weiner. Sorry to inform you. You know, you'll have to borrow Dr. Rena's or something like that. Anyway, I'm joking. That's a joke, but you know, that's sort of, but for me, one of the reasons I did come here and I decided to do this, and I give Dan Yosher all the credit for allowing me to be myself, is I thought that, you know, based on what I said before, like, you know, the fact that, you know, I have this sort of destination practice, patients travel, and I connect with them, and I'm in touch with all my old patients, and people remember sort of the human side of things. I felt like I wanted to impart that in pediatric neurosurgery. And I felt that to create an environment here in Houston where we would be technically excellent neurosurgeons, but also have that human touch. And when I sort of created the vision statement for our division, it was, you know, sort of, we're going to be the destination nationally and internationally for the highest quality, innovative, and attentive care. And I added that word, attentive care. We're going to train the future leaders, and we're going to, you know, conduct research in areas where we have, you know, specific knowledge and impact. But, you know, for me, that was sort of my main goal, was to really influence trainees in a way that they'll go out and focus on that as well and be excellent neurosurgeons. And VJ, you're a perfect example of that. Like, you know, someone who sets the example as a surgeon, but also as a human being. So I feel like in some small way, I've had a little impact here to, you know, I put that poster up on my wall, work hard and be nice to people. And, you know, it sort of changes the oxygen in the room and sets the expectations in a non-threatening way, in a non-didactic way, where this is how we roll here. And so I give the book out because it's one small indicator of a philosophy that has worked in the business world, you know, very well, financially, business-wise, without compromising, you know, on the quality side. So it's a fun read. It's about food and wine. Everybody loves food. So it's a fun, easy read. And it's a dated book already. It's, you know, probably, it's from 2006, I think. So it's already old. But, you know, there are a lot of ways we sort of live out this philosophy. I mean, I sort of talked about that. I think, you know, I mentioned, you know, developing an academic practice. I originally started talking about this publicly when they asked me here to talk about, you know, how do you build an academic practice? And I said, I don't really know, but I can tell you my experience. And I really sat down very hard and thought about these things. But I had to give a talk at, I think, the PEDS section a couple of years ago, a lunch seminar on managing complications. And I thought, this is extremely relevant. Like, you know, preventing complications is very technical, but managing complications is all about how you deal with people and how you deal with the family and how you turn a situation from an absolute disaster to, you know, one where patients are thanking you and hugging you and appreciative, even though there's been a bump in the road. My first tuberous sclerosis patient, you know, and I've operated on probably more than 200 at this point, well over that, you know, had a terrible complication. And the dad went ahead and was an advocate for us starting our first tuberous sclerosis clinic with Mr. Langone at NYU. And he has me on his scientific advisory board now for a fund. And, you know, and I'm still in touch with the girl. The patient herself is now postgraduate school. I'm still in touch with her. So I think it relates to managing complications. You know, how did I succeed here so far? You know, it's still early, 8 years in, but how does one come to a new job and get buy-in when you're not necessarily the chosen, you're the unknown outsider? How do you get buy-in by the group? And I think it's how you deal with people and how you make people feel and make everybody in the team feel special and give them, you know, give them their why. So I think the principle is universal. And if I think about it, it's sort of my personal principle of life. And it's very gratifying to have something that touches your personal and professional life. So Yeah, that's it. That's why. And, you know, it's not something I concocted and said, I need to do this. You know, it just sort of happened.
So Howie, you say it's a principle of your life. Can you tell us kind of going back, obviously, before you were a neurosurgeon, you know, where'd you grow up and what were the influences that sort of, you know, inculcated that principle that you think is?
It's interesting. It's interesting. I don't think it's something I necessarily learned, but I've always been that kind of people-oriented person. I grew up in New York, in the suburbs of New York. Very simple. I, you know, my mom, she's still with us. My mom grew up in Brooklyn. She was a classmate of Barbara Streisand. My dad was a Holocaust survivor. He was a survivor of the Auschwitz death camp. My grandparents were murdered, but I never got to know them. My grandmother was sent to the gas chamber. My grandfather died, you know, at some point. But I had a great life. That experience did not influence my upbringing. My parents are the most warm, kind, down-to-earth people. My dad was in the clothing business. My wife jokes now because I'm a bit into fashion. And I said, well, it's in my genetics. You know, I'm high-low. I wear chinos from Target. But I, you know, a lot of the other things I wear are Paul Smith or whatever. I just happen to... And people joke like, you know, it's very high, low. But I said, it's in my genes, and she doesn't get that point. But anyways, my dad was in the clothing business. He worked 6 days a week. I, you know, we never went on vacation. His busy week was Christmas week, and I would work in his store and, you know, clean stuff and hang out. And I was the first one in my family to go to college. My mom went to Brooklyn College for 2 years before she had me at age 20. And my dad didn't go, you know, my dad was brilliant, but he didn't go to school. I read the New York Times every day and was probably one of the sharpest people I knew, and my mom. And anyway, so I had a very good life. I went to this very fancy Jewish private school in Manhattan near Park Avenue. I was on financial aid. In fact, my wife and I were both financial aid, you know, all throughout private high school. And she went to Swarthmore, I went to Penn. I finished paying off my student loans sometime in my 50s after we had paid for three kids to go through 12 years of private school and four years of college each without any debt. But I was still paying my student loans off, like, you know, whatever it was, $200 a month there. So anyway, humble beginnings, but beautiful upbringing, very warm, you know, very family oriented. My sister Gail lives in Connecticut. We're still very close. And I went off to college and I wanted to be a rock and roll person. I joined a band and did that that was the formative part of my college. And then I went off to I came back to New York for medical school. And I just texted Bob Snow, who's about to retire probably. He's a neurosurgeon affiliated with Cornell. And I remember I went into his OR after my second year of medical school. And I loved the brain, and I was a neuroscience major at Penn, biological basis of behavior. But I went into his OR and I was like, that's it. I'm doing neurosurgery. I just loved it. And I actually contacted him. We were in Paris over the summer. I contacted him to thank him for just the early influence of, you know, exposing me to neurosurgery. He made fun of me because at the time I was dating my wife. And we were going to see Suzanne Vega in concert. And he's like, oh, that's wimpy music. You need to listen to Frank Zappa or something like that. And Bob Snow was like a really interesting guy. And he's probably in his 70s now, early 70s. Anyway, I went down to NYU and I trained at NYU under Joe Ransohoff and then under Pat Kelly. And I talk about that because that was the period in my life where my humanity got beaten out of me in the sense that, you know, we all went through it, right? Survival mode, and that probably lasted. And I loved my residency, but it was really hard. I was residents with Mark Sweden and Fred Lang and George Jallo and Ali Rezai, and some of the fellows were John Ragab and Mike Handler and Neil Feldstein. It was a really magical time to be at NYU, and I loved it so much. But I feel like it took me about 10 years to rediscover myself. Yeah, I'm kind of a touchy-feely person. VJ can tell you what I'm like. I mean, you know, I'm just more into, you know, when I was in first grade, There was this kid in my class named Mark who was a congenital heart patient, and we all would eat junk food and play sports, and this kid couldn't do any of that, and he was really sickly, and that made me feel really bad. So I always cared about other people's feelings, and when I was a resident at NYU, I was focused on survival. So I would say, like, after that, I kind of started to branch out again and focused on the technical aspects of neurosurgery, like we all do early on. You know, you want to save the world, and then also realizing that you know, the human side, the hospitality side of the practice was really important. And I got into this area of epilepsy surgery that I knew nothing about, but I loved the surgery. It was very cool. I loved the connections with the families. They spent a lot of time in the hospital. And I found that it created this system where, you know, it was all word of mouth, and the internet was really taking off. And all my referrals were basically from social media and word of mouth. And I felt that a lot of that was, you know, the technical part, but a lot of it was about who I was as a person, that drove a lot of that practice growth. And it was really explosive for a number of years. And then I made my way here. And, you know, so that was my childhood. I'm very into music. I'm very into running. I'm very into my roots as a Jew, and kind of rediscovered that again in my 40s. I went to Jewish school, but decided in my 40s, actually at an NYU epilepsy dinner, that I was going to start wearing my yarmulke in public. And that was a pretty big decision, but same thing. It's all the same theme, basically creating this unified vision for my life. Like I said, you only go around once. I went to my chair, Pat Kelly, who is a military guy. And I said, Dr. Kelly, I'm nervous. People are in New York, in Manhattan, are going to think I'm a freak. Like, I'm starting to wear my yarmulke. And he's like, God damn it, Howie, people are going to respect you more and see that you stand for something more than yourself. And I thought that was kind of cool. That he, you know, I really connected with Pat Kelly, and he was great. But anyway, so that was another thing. And, you know, I decided I was going to wear my yarmulke when I came to Houston. And yeah, it's been a dream down here. I've loved it. I've loved it. And I feel like, you know, once again, it's really interesting that the hospitality concept has interest. You know, I find that a lot of people have really found it interesting, and you know, it's hit a nerve in some way. It, you know, when I give talks, that nobody wants to hear about epilepsy surgery. They want to hear about this. So anyway, hope that answers your question.
Quick question for you. You know, just when you describe your upbringing and spending a majority of your life in the Northeast, and especially in the New York area, tell me about that transplant to Texas, because that's like taking a fish and putting them in Houston, right? I mean, so tell us about that and how you and your family adapted to that. And it's been 8 years, which is incredible, and where you're at now.
So we are Texans. We love it. The key is people are really nice here. Our city of Houston is so interesting because everybody moves here for a reason. You know, obviously I've made a lot of friends who grew up here, but a lot of people come here for work, particularly at the medical center, the Texas Medical Center. You know, Texas Children's is a part of that, is just incredible, and oil and gas and real estate, what have you. It's a city of, it's an international city. People come here from all over the world. And so it's this incredible mix of cultures and religions and backgrounds. And our department, actually, at Texas Children's kind of reflects that too. We're all different. We came from different backgrounds, but somehow we have this common set of core values. And I think Houston is like that. What I love about Houston is it's got everything that New York has. You know, we love New York, raised our family in New York. My wife is originally from Pittsburgh, but we met in a bar in New York City when I was a third year medical student at Cornell. And she's really a New Yorker. And Houston is everything New York has, but it's much easier. So my wife works in the Museum of Fine Arts, which is one of the best museums in the country. We partake of the theater. We just were at the ballet this past Sunday, seeing this very cool new version of Cinderella. We're members of the Alley Theater. I'm very into indie rock, so I see a lot of good shows. Yola Tango just played here. The first weekend I moved here, my favorite band Luna was playing in Houston, so I knew that was kind of an omen that I made the right decision. The food is great. There's a great Jewish community. I live two houses down from the synagogue. I'm now president of my synagogue. Don't tell anybody at my work about that. None of my partners know that, because you know, that's like the hardest job in life. But I won't get into that. But anyway, so we love Houston, but we still spend a lot of time in New York. I had a big birthday in September. So what did I want to do? I said, let's spend a week in New York. We have a little place in New York that we keep. So let's spend a week in New York with my kids. You know, we have three grown kids. That's the center of our life. My daughter's married. So going to Broadway shows and going out to restaurants and strolling through the streets. That's the one thing I complain about in Houston, is it's not a walking culture for a lot of reasons. But we used to love during residency, like just walk post-call, walking through Manhattan for like 12 hours and seeing the sights. And, you know, the energy of New York is great. But I feel like here we have a great, you know, we're empty nesters. I get up early in the morning. Today I got up at 4. I went for a run from 4:30 to 5:30. Go to synagogue, whatever, walk the dogs, get to work. The weather's great. The people are nice. It's just a very, very nice life. So anyway, this weekend I have 8 friends coming from the Northeast and elsewhere as a belated kind of birthday guys weekend. So we're going to the rodeo tonight, this is rodeo month. And then we're going to have, we had one of our neighbors smoke a brisket. I would have asked Whitehead, but next time. And then we're going to do some other fun things in Houston. So we've embraced it. We've been to lots of other cities. We happen to love San Antonio. Austin is fun for the weekend. So the transition has been relatively easy. And in the end, people are people. So, you know, people like food, people like music. So I think that we've been extremely happy here. And you know, I couldn't be happier in my job. I feel like this is, you know, it's like Disney World for neurosurgery. It's really amazing here. You know, I have the most wonderful partners, as you know. And so I feel very blessed. And, you know, I hope to stay here. I don't know what the future brings. You know, nobody ever knows. But my plan is to stay here as long as they'll have me, you know.
I have another question for you.
Yeah.
Just talking about your philosophy and how you, from a leadership perspective, get everybody on board, because not everybody sees the world the way that you do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how do you form a faculty and how do you kind of bend them towards what you're trying to accomplish, I guess?
That's a great question. My philosophy in that way was, you know, to find the best people. Like, so, you know, once again, not to steal from Danny, but there's a certain set of two concepts that I want to combine. What he talks about, and I mentioned this in my talk, is he talks about the 51% rule for hiring. And it's really important. And I completely buy into this. So in the Union Square Hospitality Group, and you know, I feel exactly the same way, they hire 49% on your technical skill and 51% on what he calls the hospitality quotient, HQ, human factors, and I'll tell you what those are. So it's not that one is, you know, it's a subtle, nuanced difference. So, you know, we want to be the best and we want to hire the technically best. So I learned early on that, you know, this place is not for the faint of heart. You have to be a good surgeon. So, you know, I've learned to do my homework about that. And certainly hiring our fellows is the best way to know somebody's skill from a technical standpoint. But so that's really important, right? To be a good technical neurosurgeon. But slightly more important that are the human skills, which are, you know, being a glass half full person. Like, so they are basically optimistic, warmth, integrity, curiosity. I can read them to you. I mean, optimistic, warmth, which means that you don't want a downer person on your team. Like in our field, you want somebody who's an upbeat, glass half full person, somebody who's got curiosity about things, somebody who's got a great work ethic, somebody who has empathy, someone who has integrity is really important. When I got interviewed for this job, I met a search firm, you know, we had a few calls and then I had to this was before Zoom, I had to do a video interview in the generic office in like a conference room, and they were filming me. And on a big wintry day in 2015 or 14, And they asked me, what's the most important thing to me? And I said, character and integrity. So those I want people with all those skills. If I had to boil down the thing that distinguishes our group, or the principle that's the most important distinguishing factor, it's people who are givers rather than takers. And it sounds overly simplistic. And, you know, Adam Grant wrote about this, and there's a lot of Jewish philosophy about this. But basically, people who are focused on other people more than themselves. So people here are burning with ambition, right? But they're for the right reason, for the patient, for the program, for neurosurgery, to leave neurosurgery better than they found it. And it's not about me, 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 me. The takers are easy to spot. We know them. They're all over neurosurgery. The people who, they're all over social media. Look at me. It's all about me. But if you have one of these people on your team, you're going to spend 80 to 90% of your time dealing with that person. This was not good enough. You get them off the bus, and we've gotten them off the bus here. We have a team of givers for the most part. You know, everybody has their moment, but, and DJ wrote this to me, one of the notes he wrote to me, which, you know, I always remember what people say to me, but like someone who's, and this was also a big principle about me coming here. It's not about me. That's one of the most important things about being a modern leader, right? Like I've heard on previous podcasts, like, you know, in the old days, it was like the top surgeon who, you know, also had an R01 who was, you know, but might not have been necessarily the most appropriate people person. I think, you know, for me, you know, it's not about me, meaning like I came here and Dan Curry's an epilepsy surgeon and I'm an epilepsy surgeon, and we evolved on different islands and we have different philosophies and we're totally different as people. Dan Curry is probably also underneath the most warm, generous, kind, warm and fuzzy person underneath all the layers. And he and I have formed a system, and very deliberately on my part, to take a back seat and let Dan take the lead and be the genius leader that he is. And I sit on my hands, and my role is to basically bring patients in the door, spend a lot of time online, you know, with families, talking to families, getting them in the door, but letting him have all the glory. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, if I don't get an open hemispherectomy case, I'm upset about it. Like, I want those cases, but I'm saying, like, give him all the glory. So that's one tangible example. And if you had Dan Curry on the program, I'm sure he would tell you the same. He and I are totally different, but it's 1 + 1 = 3. We're like a superpower team. And the key is, it's not about me. It's about how can I give to the team? How can everyone give to the team? Now, the second component of my philosophy is this, and I put this in my talk also, it's about the power of why. So people have to have their why. And what I've been, I think, very good about here is giving everybody in the team their why. I hear a lot of, some of our fellows go out and they say, wow, it's so different out there. You know, it's every person for themselves, everybody doing everything, here we're fortunate based on the volume and the city we're in and the kind of programs we have that people can have their why. They can have the thing that makes them shine and the thing that really they love and they want to devote everything to. And, you know, once again, that book that I quoted, you know, Simon Sinek is, you know, people, the success in business, and patients feel it is, you know, people do not buy your what, you know, oh, Apple makes computers. They don't even buy their how, which is they make beautiful computers, but they buy their why. Apple challenges conventional thinking about everything in the world. And that's why people buy Apple. So same thing here. You know, people see that Guillermo Aldave is like so passionate about what he does, and we give him the room and the platform and the support to do what he does, and I just stay out of the way. So I think that kind of human interaction is felt by the team, and probably the most important thing is to be a nice, kind person. So, you know, the work hard, be nice to people thing, you have to live it. You have to be it. It's a life's work, and it's really hard, and it's really a mature, you know, it's a maturity thing. You have to understand it. When I was a resident, I mean, you know, you want to get on the phone and say, why are you calling me? You know, why are you calling me about this Tylenol order? I'm the Van Wagenen fellow. Don't you know who I am? Like you have to sort of live this sense of being a good person and a nice person. And I think if you do that, you get respect and you get buy-in and it sets the tone for the team. So I have a hard time and I never tell people what to do. I never talk about you should do this many cases, you should do that. I just sort of try to be myself. I mean, that's all I can say. And for some reason it's worked so far. I don't know, Heather, if that answers your question, but.
No, I think it's a great answer. Actually, you remind me of a book I just read called Multipliers. And the premise being that a brilliant person gets great performance out of themselves, but a good leader gets brilliant performance out of 10 people. And that is a much greater effect.
Yeah. That's so you'll never see me, you'll never ever, and this is not to criticize people, but you'll never ever see me put a tweet post, I'm so honored to be invited to do this podcast, or I'm so honored to, you know, it's just not who I am. It's just not who I am. And you know, I'm embarrassed to even say that, but I think it's important as an answer to your question. If people want to know, I think that there are people out there who are trying to figure out, well, how am I going to be? And I tell them, just be yourself. It's the best way to be. Because then you'll grow into that and you'll double down on that and you'll have much more impact if you are yourself.
So I think, you know, one thing that you talked about a lot at the ASPN, and it's actually been formally placed at your lap, is mentorship. And, you know, we've often talked about mentorship in this forum, but tell us, are we doing a good job of training the future neurosurgeons these types of themes? And if not, how can we do better?
Yeah. So mentorship is so important. And, you know, for me, just, you know, personally, like the people, I've had several mentors in my life. I talk about my science mentor as being one of the most important mentors for me. And it's based on this philosophy, like Ed Ziff, he's a very highly regarded, now retired basic scientist at NYU. He was like probably one of the only Howard Hughes investigators. When I was in his lab, I knocked on his door. You know, like a month before my research year. And I said, I want to work in your lab. And he kind of laughed at me. He said, people apply to me like 3 years ahead. His first postdoc is the chair of neurobiology at Harvard, Mike Greenberg. That was his first postdoc. Anyway, Ed, while I was getting beaten up as a resident, I would go into Ed's office and, you know, and like I said, you know, I would walk in with my tail between my legs, feeling very low. And for some reason, Ed would see something in me, reflect it back, talk. I have no idea what we talked about, but I came out of that office always elevated, aspirational, feeling like $1 million. And I don't know how he did that, but he sort of turned things around and made me feel a certain way that anything was possible. So that's how I view mentorship. Like I view mentorship as like meeting that person on their level and giving them this, making them feel a certain way and giving them the sense that anything is possible, that they can achieve whatever they want. And, you know, it's very individualized. I think we're doing a great job. I look around and all of my counterparts in pediatric neurosurgery are people that I love and respect and look up to. And I think share this philosophy and live and die by it. So, I'm very pleased with what I see. I still think there are a lot of issues out there. So, you know, we talk about wellness. You know, there's a lot of focus on wellness, and I'm also involved in the wellness committee on the ASPN. And I think that's really important. But, you know, it's funny. I quoted this article I saw in the New York Times, which looked at a study of like, I don't know, 50,000 workers or something. And they found that all these wellness programs in corporate America are a failure. They don't work. And that the one thing that gives workers a sense of well-being is being a giver, like doing charity or volunteering, doing volunteer work. So we have to be cautious about this wellness program. Having said that, you know, I try to, in my mentoring role, I try to set an example of a balanced life. And I think that, you know, we were talking about this in the OR today, like when you're raising kids and you're racing and you're trying to, you know, do everything and it's very hard and you're in survival mode and it's very hard to have a balanced life. But as you kind of emerge from that, being a balanced human being makes the team feel better. You know, your patients see it. They see that you're grounded. Ed Smith and I talk about this a little bit. I think that find what makes you tick. Like, I like to run. I love music. You know, whatever it is, art or something. And I think that, so I try to set an example. I mean, one of the best compliments I got from one of the senior residents here is I like to have the residents over for meals. And my son during COVID, my older son, Noah, got me a cocktail making kit. And so I would have the residents over and they would like humor me and let me make bad cocktails for them. One of the residents wrote me this really nice note that said, like, you showed us that neurosurgery is a life to be celebrated. Like, you know, I have a rich life of family and friends and, you know, neurosurgery is, you know, obviously very important to me and the focus of my life. But, you know, when I'm done with a hard case, I go to synagogue and I'm thankful and I can, you know, so I try to, as a mentor, once again, not to be prescriptive. It's very similar to my role as the team leader. I'm not prescriptive. I don't tell people what to do, do this, do that, sign up for this wellness course. You know, I try to just set an example and also, you know, make it fun here. So let's have a happy hour. Let's you know, hang out. Let's have jackets, you know, let's make these cool jackets for, you know, that we can walk around the hospital proud of. And I don't know. So, you know, it's really very much just, walking the walk and not talking the talk. Like, just that's how I feel. And I, you know, I think it's important to, I personally feel it's important to focus on family and friends. I think it's important to, you know, cultivate your body and soul. I think it's important to have big aspirational vision, go big or go home, have important role models or mentors, find your why, you know, focus. You know, we try to be all things to all people when we're starting out in our academic careers. But, you know, I think that the key to success in neurosurgery is having a focus and finding your why. And also be very attentive to the environment around you. That's what I tell folks is, you know, don't try to be an epilepsy surgeon if there's one general neurologist at your hospital that's not interested in epilepsy. Like you want to marry your passion with what the needs of that environment are. And once you do that, it's going to be a smashing success. So, you know, I didn't start out as an epilepsy surgeon, but I, you know, my senior partner at NYU was really into midline tumors and he was going to do every cranial and pineal tumor. And I, you know, so I'm going to pivot. And I found a path that really spoke to me. And it wasn't my original intention, but I was kind of paying attention to what was going on around me and marrying it with my personal skills or passions. So those are sort of my mentoring ideas. And, you know, I also tell people, don't let the things get you down. Like, you know, darkness will lead to light, like the complications lead to growth and you will be a better person because you fell down, you know, not despite it, but because you fell down, you will grow and be stronger. So these are some of the kind of mentoring principles that I try to share.
Dr. Weiner, that was great.
I want to know, Howie, what instrument did you play in your rock band?
I play bass.
Like Dave Limbrick.
Yeah. So I have very secret music love affairs with several other pediatric neurosurgeons. Dave Limbrick and I talk about bass guitar a lot, and we're both into very obscure music, different. Here's a nugget. Jay Wellens and I have discovered that we're both super obsessed with the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed. So he'll text, like, I was on my run yesterday morning and he'll text me like a Velvet Underground song. And so it's really interesting the important place music has, but I play bass. What do you play, Jim?
So I mean, I grew up playing piano and, you know, mostly classical. And I my biggest regret is I didn't learn how to, I always wanted to be like a rhythm guitarist for a punk rock band or a speed metal band. And I never acted on that. And I still regret it. So when Dave, you know, when Dave's, of course, his career as a bass player for, you know, that for On Beyond Z and as a jam band and all that, I've always think that's just such an amazing thing. So when you mentioned that, I wanted to hear more about it.
Yeah. So I answered an ad my freshman year at Penn in the Speakman in the quad in the mailroom to join a band. And, you know, people ask me like why my social life was so bad, because I didn't join a fraternity because I answered this ad and I auditioned and I played with these other guys, all of whom went on to very successful careers and are now retired. We had a reunion recently during COVID, a Zoom reunion. One guy is the lead head of the Major League Baseball Players Association, Bruce Meyer. Gary Israel is a retired partner. He went to Stanford Law School, and Chris Pericles graduated from Wharton and worked in, you know, Wall Street or something. And then we had one guy who lived in West Philly who didn't go to the college, who, you know, is doing something else out. And he was in California for a while, but we were a new wave dance band. That was the term back then. We played like Talking Heads, The Clash, Elvis Costello, The Pretenders, you know, that kind of music, which was not popular at the time.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And now my kids play, my son plays classical piano and my other son plays drums and bass. And,
that's cool.
Yes. Yeah, anyway.
There are a lot of musicians in pediatric neurosurgery. I feel like when you ask people, more and more people, you know, say they did it. So anyway.
It was great. I really enjoyed it. I think I wish that, I mean, I hope that it's a message that resonates outside of pediatric neurosurgery and throughout our field more and more.
Yeah.